We're very honored to have our next guest aboard, and his name is Dr. John Small, and he's joining us now by telephone from Kingston. Dr. Small is a professor in biology at Queen's University in Ontario. He's one of the world's leading Arctic researchers, and he has just told me that he's going tomorrow to pick up his prize as the winner of the 2013 Weston Family Prize for Lifetime Achievement for Northern Research. That comes along with, I believe, a $50,000 award. He was recently named by Canadian Geographic as one of the leading Canadians changing Canada and the world, and he's a pioneer in the field of paleolimnology. Dr. Small, it's so nice to have you aboard. Thank you so much for giving us your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
When I read the term paleolimnology, the first thing I thought about, well, I know it's referring to something in the past, I believe, but I had no idea what that term meant. Maybe you can tell the folks out there in our listening audience what that refers to.
Yes, it's a mouthful, the term, but it's a fairly straightforward field. Limnology is the study of lakes and rivers, so it's the freshwater, the inland side of oceanography, which maybe people are more familiar with. And paleo means the past, so you hit it on the nose. It's basically the history of lakes and rivers, and it's a fairly straightforward field in some respects. As you appreciate, lakes slowly fill with mud, 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year, mud is slowly accumulating at the bottom of a lake. Well, that might look like mud to most people, and it is mud, but that mud contains an incredible history of what happened in the lake, and also from the surrounding watershed, the land around it. The lake, it's like a time machine. Slowly, material is accumulating at the bottom. Well, in that mud is an incredible library of information. Virtually everything that lived in that lake is leaving some sort of fossil. Now, some of it is often it's microscopic, like the hard parts of algae or the hard parts of, like the water fleas and the aquatic insects you see, which we can identify to like the species level and try and reconstruct environmental change, but also a whole host of chemical precipitates and also material coming from outside the lake basin, things like pollen grains. If anyone has hay fever, they know at certain times of the year there's a lot of pollen in the air. Well, different tree species produce different types of pollen grains, and they're very well preserved in lake sediments. And so if you can identify the pollen grains to the type of tree, which we can do, then you can reconstruct how terrestrial systems have changed. And that gives you information on past climate, because we associate, different trees with different climates. It also tells you when farming started, and so on and so forth. So what we do is we reconstruct the ecological history of lakes. So we go and we take a sediment core. It's basically a profile or a tube of the lake sediments. There's different ways to do that. It's not too complicated. It's mostly, the surface is very wet, so we have to be very careful. And, of course, the surface is where human impacts are. That's most of our focus is often on the last 200 years of history, and that's usually in the top, I'll switch to feet here. I'm used to using the metric system.
Sure.
In about the last 2 feet of the lake sediments, about half a meter, there is usually about the last 200 years of the lake's history, and that's a very watery sediment. So we have ways of taking that core, which is fairly straightforward. It's often like I use the analogy of a straw in a milkshake. You slowly lower a tube on a rope. It's a little more complicated than that, but it's like putting your thumb on top of the straw and pulling it up. You've captured the last few hundred years of lake history, and then you slice very fine intervals, and you go back in time. And we have independent ways of dating that. I think most of your listeners are probably know about C14 dating or radiocarbon dating that archaeologists use. Well, we use that for the older material, but we have other types of isotopes to say, like, this is the 1920s or this is the 1850s. And then we look at the fossils in these different time slices, and we can reconstruct what the lake was like and what the surrounding vegetation was like. And this gives us all sorts of information. I mean, this technique's been used all through Minnesota and the Midwest. For example, how has farming affected lakes? When did algal bloom start? That's just one example. It's a big water quality question. It's been used to reconstruct past climate. Just like if I showed you a picture of a polar bear and I showed you, you'd know right away something about the climate. It's cold. It's in the Arctic because there's no polar bears in the Antarctic. It's near the ocean because they only eat seals. And if I showed you a camel, you'd have another idea of what the environment was like. Well, it's the same thing with all these fossils. We spend a lot of time determining where they live, and then we can reconstruct how the environment has changed over time. So this has been used for acid rain all through the United States. When did lakes acidify? Well, when the acid species started coming in, and we can date when it was, and we say this lake acidified in the 1920s or 1930s. When did climate start changing? Is something strange happening in the climate? Is this all part of the natural system? All this we put together, and we can reconstruct because that's one of the biggest challenges we have in environmental work. The biggest challenges is we don't have the long-term monitoring data. No one was measuring the acidity of Minnesota lakes, let's say, in the 1800s or the 1700s. No one was measuring how much nutrients were coming in from farmers' fields in the turn of the century, of the last century. The only way we can get at this information is these indirect methods. And so the lake sediments is really a history book of how things have changed over time.
It sounds amazingly complex to get a tube that contains, you know, a microcosm of what was going on in that lake sediment and pull all that information. How long have you been involved in this field?
Yeah, I guess since I'm a grad student, that's going back 30 years now. I try not to think about that. But about 30 years I've been dealing with it. It was a fairly young science then. But now there's quite a few labs doing these types of approaches. But yes, it does involve a fair number of steps. You're sitting at the microscope for a long time. A lot of it is, for example, taxonomy. You're looking at bits and pieces of what lived in a lake. You know, like most people will know what water fleas look like or aquatic insects. Well, unfortunately, the whole insect or the whole water flea doesn't preserve. They break into little parts, but those parts are diagnostic. It's a bit like, you know, paleontologists. They find a bone and they say this is a bone from, you know, Tyrannosaurus rex or something. We're doing kind of the same thing, but at a microscopic level. It's all done with high-level microscopes and stuff. But it's actually quite fascinating to see how lakes have changed, and it's very exciting, I think, in many ways. And of course, it's everything from the theoretical side, you know, looking at some esoteric questions, to very applied issues like, you know, farmers, what effect have farmers had? It's not just the biology. We also look at things like PCBs, DDT, mercury, lead, all the things that most people are interested in. So we can do both of those and reconstruct how those have changed over time.
In the field of climate change, we hear a lot about core samples that are taken, let's say, from the ice cap in Greenland or from glaciers around the world. Does your type of research with lake bottoms, can you relate that data directly to what they're finding in the ice as well?
Yes, that's a very good question. Much of what you hear about long-term climate change is from the ice cores, which use the same sort of principle, except they're not at the bottom of a lake. They're looking at how much ice accumulates in the isotopes in the ice, and that's mainly from Greenland and Antarctica and places like that, parts of the Canadian Arctic as well. Yes, the ice cores are very important. The problem with ice cores is they're extremely expensive to get. I think, you know, when they took the first ice cores, the U.S. took the first ice cores in the 1990s, just collecting the ice core, I think, was millions and millions of dollars. And also, there's not much ecology in the ice cores. The ice is just measuring, you know, the deposition of snow and ice accumulation. The advantage of looking at lakes is we can have very broad spatial coverage. You know, we can look at many lakes on a continent, and also we can track what the ecology, what the biology is doing, which, of course, you can't do very much in an ice core because there's not much biology there. But, yes, we work very closely not only with the ice core people. We work closely with the tree ring people, for example. You know, everywhere around us are these passive samplers of the environment. One of those are the trees around you. The trees have these tree rings, of course, and I'm sure everyone has cut down a tree and counted tree rings. Notice they're in different sizes. Well, there's that whole field of dendrochronology that looks at the size and the density of the tree rings, and that gives you some information of how fast the tree grew and, again, paleoclimate information. So there's many sources of this, but the work on lake sediments is really becoming a major source, especially in some areas like where I work in the Arctic, the high Arctic. There are no trees. You know, we're way past tree line, so you don't really have the option of using tree rings. So you're kind of left with things like, of course, one thing there is a lot of in that part of the world is a lot of lakes. So we can use the lake sediments to reconstruct how climate has changed.
When I think about sediment in the bottom of the lakes, I think, well, these lakes are transitory. You know, maybe however many years ago, they weren't in the location where they are now. Are you limited in how far back you can go to study this sediment?
Yeah, it depends where you are on the continent. But in North America, at least in the, you know, northern Minnesota, northern Midwest, places like Maine, New England, and almost all of Canada, the lakes go back about till the last ice age. Which is the retreat of the last ice age, which is about, say, 12,000 years ago. So we have pretty good core records going back, you know, assuming it's not a very small pond or part of a river. Most permanent water bodies go back in this part of the world about 12,000 years. Now, you can go to other parts of the world where they didn't have glaciers. But one of the aspects of the glaciers, when the big ice sheets came, they sort of, you know, bulldozed the land, and they removed any former lake beds that we had. So they're all relatively young on the geological scale, about 12,000 years. But you go to places like Africa or Lake Baikal in Siberia, you know, some of these, they go back millions of years. So you can actually push the record back quite far.
You mentioned that a lot of your work is done in the high Arctic. What is it about the high Arctic that makes the climate change and the effects of it show up other than
So
the surface?
strikingly, the Arctic polar regions are especially sensitive to the effects of climate change, and they do so to the greatest degree, and also for other environmental issues, but really climate change. And a lot of that has to do with albedo. There's several factors, but albedo is a fancy word for brightness, if you like. And I use an analogy. If I went out on a hot summer day in August in the parking lot in front of your radio station, and there's a white car and a black car, I put my hands on both cars, they'd both be hot, but the black car would be hotter. And that's because the black car has low albedo, it's absorbing a lot of heat, whereas the white car is high albedo, high brightness, is acting like a mirror. The normal state, if you like, of the Arctic or the Antarctic is ice and snow. Ice and snow is like one big mirror. It has high albedo, it's highly reflecting the heat coming from the sun. Once you start warming the planet like we have been with greenhouse gases, you start losing that whiteness. You go from, if you're in the sea, you go from a white sea ice to the dark color of the ocean. That dark color of the ocean is going to heat even more. It's going to melt more sea ice. You know, you get a positive feedback system thing. Things just start going very quickly. Same thing on land. You lose the snow and ice longer in the summer. That the brown earth or the rocks heat up even more. They melt more ice. So again, these positive feedback systems. So things happen very, very quickly in Arctic regions.
When things are happening as quickly as they are, do they still show up as easily in the sediment?
Yes, they show up quite strikingly. You know, when I say quickly, it's still over years. And most of the fossils we're using, they have very short life cycles. Things like algae or these small little invertebrate animals, many of them only have life cycles of a few days. So you can actually see tremendous changes. In fact, some of our high Arctic material, we almost see 100% change in species. You know, it's going from something that, you know, was one type and then going to a whole different group of species that now can need a longer summer to live and less ice cover. And so we can see very striking changes. So they're quite sensitive.
I think you've spent quite a bit of time looking at Arctic pools up there where
That's right. Mm-hmm.
it's the climate change has other effects. Can you explain to folks what the concern is?
Yes, well, there's many concerns. One is there's less ice cover, which is maybe not, one may argue, well, that's not really a concern because there could be more production going on in the lake, which, you know, with climate change, there's always winners and losers, too. But there's been some striking losers with climate change. I've been working for almost 30 years on some very shallow ponds. One of the most characteristic features of water in the Arctic are these shallow ponds, you know, maybe the size of the size of your bungalow or something, and often they're quite shallow, you know, a few feet deep or 2 feet deep. They look insignificant, but they're a very large part of the water base up there, and of course they're habitat for birds and everything else. Well, one thing we've been watching is these ponds, over even the 30 years we've been monitoring, getting shallower and shallower and shallower, and they're evaporating away, basically. And also, if you do the water chemistry on the ponds, you know, they're getting saltier and saltier and saltier, and use the analogy of, you know, what's happening? Well, if you put a pot of soup on the stove and you take the lid off and you have it on low heat, that's kind of what the Arctic's becoming in some areas. Two things happen to your soup over time. One, the soup level keeps going lower and lower. That's exactly what we see in the ponds. They're going to the point of disappearing, drying up. If you keep tasting your soup, it gets saltier and saltier, and that's because the water is evaporating and leaving the salts behind. That's exactly what's been happening in the water chemistry. They get saltier and saltier. So you can see that the water chemistry is changing, the biology is changing, and we can go back thousands of years and show this hasn't happened before. So we really are entering new, you know, sort of, we call them regime shift type changes. The entire ecology is shifting with, you know, some major consequences.
I believe that a lot of your research and your research group's work on paleolimnology, studying of sediment, has been a basis of a lot of what we're hearing about climate change. How come we don't hear more about your field itself?
Well, it's been, I think, somewhat influential. I think you hear about it now and then, but usually it's under the context of long-term environmental change. When we see some of these IPCC reports or the other types of reports, they just give sort of a summary of the long-term environmental change, and that's usually pulling together things like lake sediment cores, like the ice cores, like the tree ring cores. So I think it is making an impact. It's just taking a while to get recognized. I think that's a separate field. But it's, you know, the field's been used for many other things too, like acid rain and so on and so forth. And it certainly had, I think, you know, had various successes that have been somewhat recognized.
As we look at acid rain and climate change and the problems that human impact have had on them, and we also look at a lot of the kind of the major hurdles, whether they're cultural, economic, political, in coming up with solutions. You're seeing these things at a level that most people never see them. If you could just grab a magic wand and move it across, what things would you change to try to control the problems we're looking at?
Well, I think the biggest problem, we have many problems happening simultaneously, but I really believe the biggest one is climate change, human-induced climate change. And I think I call it the threat multiplier simply because it's a kind of a wicked problem. You know, it affects certainly directly things with climate, but affects things indirectly too. It tends to what we call synergistic changes. Very often, other problems are even made worse, like algal blooms and so on and so forth. So I think that's the big one we really have, and it's a tough problem to, you know, a tough nut to crack in some ways. But I really would encourage people to take this climate change very, very seriously and realize we are changing the physics and chemistry of our atmosphere, and we're running out of time to make significant changes. But, you know, the problem is we got to cut down our use of fossil fuels and stop this incredible increase in greenhouse gases, and we're not very good at slowing it down, let alone reversing it. So if I had a magic wand, I'd somehow find a way to stop, getting our, never mind leveling off our greenhouse gases, trying to slow down our input.
Yeah. Well, we live right here in Minnesota, where our radio station is right on the shores of Lake Superior. And, of course, in our backyard, we have the Boundary Waters Canoe Area and also the Quetico Canoe Area. And, of course, that makes us very thoughtful about water. It's in our minds a lot. Being in Kingston, you have the St. Lawrence Seaway.
Mm-hmm. And right on Lake Ontario.
Ontario.
I can see Lake Ontario from my office window.
What kind of things do you see now? We're not in the Arctic, but yet things are changing. Here we're seeing Lake Superior warm up more dramatically than the outside air. What kinds of things do you see locally there with your
water? Yeah, the same thing. I mean, water levels, for example, in Lake Ontario are going down because, you know, again, evaporation and less water coming in. You know, in contrast to the oceans that are going up, it's like a wicked problem. You know, oceans, you don't want going higher water levels. They're going higher because the Greenland ice cap is melting, and also just because of heat, they're expanding. So you get flooding from oceans. But freshwaters tend to be declining, like the Great Lakes. We see the shorelines being exposed. We see local lakes. One thing we think and we haven't got these connections really worked out totally, but we're seeing more algal blooms. And even though we think of algal blooms as linked to nutrients, which is, of course, part of the story, but we now think that because of this warming and the longer period of open water, no ice conditions, longer period of what we call thermal stratification when the lake heats up into three different areas, we're seeing more algal blooms that are not really, sometimes nutrients are even going down and we have more noticeable algal blooms. That's, again, like one of these wicked problems you're getting with climate change. All sorts of things, different bird species moving in, other bird species under great stress because the habitats are disappearing. The wetlands around the Great Lakes are disappearing because they're drying up. So it's really this whole symphony of problems happening. And this has strong, never mind ecological costs, it does have strong environmental costs, and it has strong economic costs. Fisheries are might possibly declining. And so, you know, people always say, what's the cost of dealing with climate change? My argument is, what's the cost of not dealing with climate change? That's the question we should be asking. It's hardly a cost to deal with it. We have to deal with it, or it's going to have very, very serious problems.
We've been speaking with Dr. John Small, and Dr. Small is a professor in biology at Queen's University in Ontario. He's one of the world's leading Arctic researchers and a pioneer in the field of paleolimnology. Dr. Small, I want to thank you so much for giving us your time today and congratulate you, in winning the 2013 Weston Family Prize for Lifetime Achievement. That's quite an accomplishment, and also the best for your research in the future.
Well, thank you very much. Delighted to talk.